Well, we are creatures of worry, aren't we? Now, that's not necessarily a bad or a wrong thing. It's kind of built into our human nature, and for good reason. We need to have some level of worry to keep us motivated to do what we need to do. If I had no worries whatsoever about providing for my family, then my motivation for getting to work on time would be greatly diminished. If we didn't have some level of worry for our kids, how our kids would develop into adults, then we might let them do whatever they wanted to do. If we didn't have some level of concern or worry over whether we'll be considered qualified to be qualified by God to be a part of His kingdom, then we wouldn't be examining ourselves to the degree that we should be. So, worry can be healthy. Worry, when kept in control, can be good for us. When kept in control is the key phrase there. We can't let it get out of control. We could very easily go down a train of thought where we obsess and we worry over things that are completely out of our control, okay? The fact that radioactive material has been stolen from Chernobyl, not much we can do about that, so let's not worry about it. The fact that our borders are completely open, I'm sure it's gonna be fine, okay? There's nothing we can do about those things. So what am I doing on a daily basis to bring myself in alignment with the example of Jesus Christ? That's something I can worry about because it's something I can do something about. So worry and concern are tied directly with action. If we worry about something that we can't do something about, it's pointless. It's vanity. If we worry about something we can do something about, but yet don't do anything, that's also pointless vanity. Our worry should motivate us to action. But there's more to it. As we take action to mitigate the issues that we're worried about, we should keep the big picture in mind. Because, every morning I wake up and I have some breakfast, I go to work, a few hours later, I'm hungry again. Okay, my body is saying, yo guy, need some food. But my stomach doesn't have the ability to understand the context of what day it is. So a little over a week ago, had some breakfast and then go to have lunch, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I probably shouldn't have much for lunch because it's gonna be the night to be much observed and I'm gonna eat a lot. So I think I still had a pretty good lunch, but we need to keep those things, we need to keep that context, what day it is, okay? The circumstances that surround our worry, we kind of have to keep that in mind. Well, today I'd like to review a story in the Bible that we all know, but I'd like to highlight the deep grief and worry that was present, how they took action, and how extremely easy it was for them to completely lose sight of the context, the circumstances surrounding their worry. Now, I don't blame them for that at all. It's a lesson for us. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 41. Genesis chapter 41. Now, we all know the story here. This is, we all know the story of Joseph. We've heard it a bunch of times. You know, as an older teen, as all of us when we were older teens, he was lacking humility, right? He really got under his brother's skin, and they sold him to some traders that were on their way to Egypt. He becomes a slave, and as things are starting to look up for him, he's thrown into prison. And now Joseph was blessed, and he had the opportunity to learn some humility by being in prison. Then, a few years go by, and Pharaoh has this dream, and Joseph interprets it for him, saying, well, there's going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh tells him, okay, so, go do something about it. And he puts Joseph in charge. So that's the 30-second version of that story, right? Fast forward 7 years, and now the years of plenty are over, and the famine is starting to set in. Genesis 41, and we'll pick it up in verse 53. Then the 7 years of plenty which were in the land of Egypt ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come as Joseph had said. The famine was in all lands, but in the land of Egypt there was bread. So the 7 years of plenty have ended, and the famine is setting in. Let's jump over to chapter 42 now in verse 1. When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another? Why do you look at one another? Why are, you know," they were worried. They had never seen anything that was near this bad before, and they didn't know what to do. Now, I'm not a farmer, but if the crops have failed, there's not a whole lot you can do about it. So they're just kind of sitting around looking at each other. What do we do? I'm sure they didn't have crop insurance in those days, but even then, what good does your money do if there's nothing to buy? Okay? So they're worried, and rightly so. Verse 2. And he said, "Indeed, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there, that we may live and not die." So Jacob sends his sons to Egypt to buy grain, that we may live and not die. Okay, calm down, right? This is Jacob. This is the one, I mean, one of God's names is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So what is he worried about? Let's turn back a little bit here to Genesis chapter 28. This is Jacob. Genesis 28, and we'll go verse 10 through 15. "Now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it under his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. And then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven. And there were angels of God, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold," verse 13, "the Lord stood above it and said, 'I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Also, your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. And in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you." So God makes this amazing promise to Jacob. How could Jacob forget this? Okay? Maybe he didn't. Maybe he was thinking, oh, that's what God meant when he said he was going to turn my family to dust. No, not the problem is time. The problem is time. Time is the enemy of that context that I mentioned earlier. Our human nature makes it difficult to maintain a perspective over long periods of time. So when did this happen compared to when the famine set in? Now, buckle up, we're gonna do some math, okay? Joseph was about 17 when he was sold into slavery. He was about 30, so about 13 years later, he becomes the governor of Egypt. Now this is 7 years after that. So Joseph is about 37 years old now. Now we don't need to turn there, but the Bible tells us that Joseph was born at the end of that second year period. Remember, Jacob had to work for Laban for 14 years, 7 years for Leah, and then 7 years for Rachel, okay? So Joseph was born at the end of that 7 year period. So if we add that 14 to 37, we can see it's been 51 years since he had this vision. When this is depicted in the movies, they often make it look like, you know, Jacob's sons are young men, but they weren't all that young. The older sons, especially, had families of their own. The Bible tells us there were 66 members of the family that later migrated to Egypt. Okay, so think about this. For 51 years, Jacob has been telling his family about God's promise, and they've seen nothing of it, at least in their minds. This was the same thing that his dad was talking about too, and it's the same thing that his dad's dad was talking about, okay? So what does our human nature incline us to do? It makes us doubt. At this point in Jacob's life, his father, Isaac, is dead, and Rachel also is dead. At this point, you have to imagine whatever faith Jacob's sons had in the promise is on shaky ground. You know, okay, Grandpa, right, go ahead and you know, tell us how we're going to be this great nation. You know, maybe that will take our minds off the fact that, you know, we're starving to death, okay? So you have to think that this doubt has begun to affect Jacob also. So he sends them to Egypt to buy grain. Now, Egypt wasn't down the street. This wasn't the corner grocery store. When the pandemic was, you know, at the worst and people were going crazy, it was sometimes hard to find things at the store. You know, and when Alicia would need me to go to the store, it's 5 minutes, you know, down the block and around the corner. And, you know, sometimes I'd get there and, well, they're out. They don't have any more. So I'd get out my phone and do some looking for the other Walmarts in the area. And I'm like, well, okay, there's the one at Goddard. They've got it. So I can just run over there. And inevitably, Alicia would say, no, I don't want you to go all that way. It's 10 minutes. You know? So that's not what we're talking about. It's not 10 minutes. Egypt was well over 500 miles away. Now, imagine, again, the pandemic, but instead of driving 10 minutes, we have to form a group that has to go out and try to buy food, and someone says, hey, I hear there's food somewhere on the other side of Denver. They've got food out there. Now, and that's not even counting as the crow flies. That's going up and over. This is a daunting task. Oh, I hear there's food on the other side of Des Moines, Iowa. And by the way, you're walking, okay? There's no cell phones, no cars. These men are sent to Egypt on a month-long journey, at least a month, and who knows what will happen along the way. So that's the background for what's going on here. Genesis, let's go back to Genesis 42 and verse 2. Genesis 42, again, verse 2, and not die, that we may live and not die. This has affected them all to the point where they're ready to mount a party and go over 500 miles to try to buy food. Verse 3, so Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. Let's skip down to verse 8 now. So they, you know, they do get down to Egypt, and they present themselves to Joseph. Verse 8. So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, you are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land. Now let's stop here. Joseph was an Egyptian governor. He was not a homely sheep herder. Now this might as well have been Yul Brynner, okay, barking at them. They didn't know this guy as Joseph. They knew him as Zaphnath-Paneah, okay? Have you ever thought about this aspect? You know, they could tell from the prison tats on his arm that he was a mean dude, all right? You know, while other Egyptian rulers probably looked like, you know, trust fund kids, this was Zaphnath-Paneah. I hope you got that copy and paste there. This guy worked his way up from being a slave, spent hard time in an Egyptian prison, and is now effectively the ruler of all Egypt. I have no doubt that he would have been a very intimidating man to stand in front of. So let's continue on. Jump down to verse 14. But Joseph said to them, it is as I spoke to you, saying, you are spies. In this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. And he put them all together in prison 3 days. Then Joseph said to them the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, But you go and carry grain for the famine of your houses, and bring your youngest brother to me. So your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. Then they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore this distress has come upon us. And Reuben answered them, saying, did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us. Verse 23, but they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. They're really shaken up by this whole ordeal, okay? So you've got Yul Brynner yelling at you, all right? And not in a nice English accent. He's speaking Egyptian. Now, that's not a language that's spoken today, but if it's close to Arabic at all, you would have heard something like this. Antem ajawa sishu. I mean, it just kind of strikes some fear in your mind. You don't have to wait for a translator to know that's not good. Antem ajawa sishu. You are spies. Then verse 24, kind of at the end, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. In the minds of Jacob's sons, the blood guilt of their brother Joseph has been hanging over them for 20 years. They've had this in the back of their minds, and it's been on their minds for 20 years. And that blood guilt has now come full circle. Their families are on the verge of starvation, and they risked an incredible journey into a hostile land in a last-ditch effort to try to eke out, you know, a subsistence through this awful famine. And on top of that, they must now pay the price for the murder of their brother. Let's pick it up again in verse 25. Then Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain, to restore every man's money to his sack, and to give them the provisions for their journey. So they buy the grain, but Joseph makes them put the money back into the sack. Thus he did for them, verse 26. So they loaded their donkeys with grain and departed from there. But as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey feed at the encampment, he saw his money, and there it was in the mouth of his sack. So he said to his brothers, my money has been restored, and there it is in my sack. Then their hearts failed them, and they were afraid, saying to one another, what is that? What is this that God has done to us? If you go buy food at the grocery store, okay, and you go out to the parking lot, and you notice that even though you paid for the food, you still have all your money, you might think, wow, what an amazing blessing, okay? But this, they hadn't just gone to a grocery store. Imagine if you had gone to buy food from a mob boss, all right? Someone who is completely beyond the reach of law, someone who holds your life in his hand and makes sure that you know it. They didn't see this as a blessing. They saw it as a curse, and their agony goes even further. He's going to think that we robbed him. Now, I've never met a mob boss, but I've seen enough TV to know they don't take kindly to being robbed. Okay? Now, the cost of grain, as you can imagine, this is a famine, the cost of grain has skyrocketed. And you can read in the Bible about how very quickly Egypt turned from a capitalist economy into a communist, very tightly government-run economy almost overnight. So as they're leaving, they realize that not only did they have the grain, but they had all of their money too. In their minds, they're thinking, we're being set up. So now they are even more worried. Drop down to verse 35. Then it happened, as they emptied their sacks, that surprisingly each man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And you want to take Benjamin. All these things are against me. Now remember, Joseph said you have to bring Benjamin back. If you want Simeon, you have to bring him back. So now Jacob is saying, well, Simeon's gone because you're not taking Benjamin. So they are even more distressed. All these things are against me, Jacob says. Continuing on. Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, "Kill my two sons, if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you." Imagine things being so bad that you say something like this. Now, maybe he was just that overconfident, or maybe he figured, well, you know, if we don't succeed, then we're not going to live anyway. Okay, but imagine things being so bad that you say that. Verse 38. But he said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, then you would bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave." The despair of the family is mounting, okay? Continuing on, chapter 43 now, we'll pick it up verse 1. Now the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass, when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, "Go back and buy us a little food." Okay, things are still bad, and they're getting worse. They've eaten up all of the grain that they had brought in back. Verse 3, but Judah spoke to him, saying, "The man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we will go down and buy food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, "You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you."' And Israel said, 'Why did you deal so wrongfully with me as to tell the man whether you had another brother?'" Of course, they have no idea who Zaphnath-Paneah is, okay? But they said, "The man asked us pointedly about ourselves and our family, saying, 'Is your father still alive? Have you another brother?' And we told him according to these words. Could we possibly have known that he would say, 'Bring your brother down'?" They didn't know he was going to say that. Can you just, you can feel, when you kind of put yourself in their shoes, you can kind of feel that despair just mounting and mounting. Verse 8, "Then Judah said to Israel, his father, 'Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you, and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. For if we had not lingered, surely we would have returned the second time." Verse 11, "And their father Israel said to them, 'If it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best fruits of the land in your vessels, carry down a present for the man, a little balm, a little honey, spices, myrrh, pistachio, nuts, and almonds. Take double money in your hand, and take back the money, take back in your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take your brother also, and arise and go back to the man. And may God Almighty give you mercy before the man, that he may release your other brother and Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved.'" They are at rock bottom. And again, they had no choice but to go back to Egypt. The last time that they left, they lost Simeon, a man who surely had a family of his own. And now they have no choice but to risk the journey again, this time taking their youngest brother. And Jacob resolves himself with the idea that two of his sons are now dead, and he's about to lose a third. "If I am bereaved, I am bereaved." And as you know, the story is far from over. So they go down to Egypt, taking Benjamin with them, and they arrive in Egypt, and things seem to go well. I'll pick it up in verse 15 here. "So the men took the present and Benjamin, and they took double money in their hand, and arose and went down to Egypt, and they stood before Joseph. And when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, 'Take these men to my home, and slaughter an animal, and make ready, for these men will dine with me at noon.' Then the man did as Joseph ordered, and the man brought the men into Joseph's house." But understand for a moment the mindset that these guys are in and the despair that hangs over them. They're not going to meet the governor. If I get something in the mail saying, "Hey, you know, come meet the governor," I'm like, "Oh, okay, let's do it," right? This might as well have been Vladimir Putin to them. How would you feel if you go to Russia and someone says, "Oh yeah, come in, Mr. Putin would like to have a word with you"? That's not going to leave an easy feeling in your stomach. verse 18. Now the men were afraid because they were brought into Joseph's house, and they said, "It is because of the money which was returned in our sacks the first time that we are brought in, so that he may make a case against us and seize us and take us as slaves with our donkeys." It may sound like they're being overdramatic, but yeah, I've been trying to bring as much color to the story as I can to convey that if we had been in their shoes, this is exactly how we would have felt. It's all over. This is it. This is how it ends. Our lives are over. That's it. But despite their worst fears, things do go well. Let's skip down to verse 23. "But he," Joseph, "said, 'Peace with you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money.' And then he brought Simeon out to them." That's a phrase I am going to try to keep in mind. Your God and the God of your father has given you the treasure in your sacks. You know that God's there, God's taking care of us. But continuing on. So the man, verse 24, "So the man brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet, and he gave their donkeys feed." Now, again, this sounds nice. Things are going well, but they must have felt like lambs going to the slaughter here. But the evening goes well. Everyone eats and drinks and has a good time. And then, let's jump over to chapter 44. Chapter 44 and verse 1. "And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, 'Fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. And also put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his grain money.' So he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken." Now, again, I kind of look at this like, you know, the servant didn't say, "What are you doing?" No, you don't mess with Zaphnath-Paneah, okay? You do what he says. So, continuing on. So he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. Verse 3. "As soon as the morning had dawned, the men were sent away, they and their donkeys." Now, imagine sort of the shock of this happening. To go from, you know, we're all going to die in an Egyptian prison to... I skipped ahead, sorry. again, they have no idea that this is Joseph. For them, this is, again, like being invited into Vladimir Putin's home, and then on your way out the door, they catch you trying to steal his vodka, okay? You know, you steal from President Biden, you're going to go before the court of law. But Vladimir Putin is the law in Russia. He's not going to mess around with courts. Neither do you cross a man like Zaphnath-Paneah. So, verse 4, "When they had gone out of the city and were not yet far off, Joseph said to his steward, 'Get up and follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is not the one from which my lord drinks and with which he practices divination, you have done evil in so doing?'" So they set up this trap to catch them, okay? Jump down to verse 10. "And he said, 'Now also let it be according to your words.'" So again, they stop them and, you know, they find the cup in Benjamin's sack, and they say, "No, you know, please don't kill him. Please, you know, whoever has the cup, you know, whoever has the cup, you know, take him." Verse 10. "And he said, 'Now let it also be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my slave, and you shall be blameless.' Then each man speedily let down his sack to the ground, and each opened his sack. So he searched. He began with the oldest and left off with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city." So, again, they've kind of had this huge change. They thought they were home free, and now they're being drugged back, all the way back. Jump down to verse 33. So now Judah sees everything that's happening. He intercedes for Benjamin. So this is Judah talking. He says, "Now therefore, please let your servant remain himself instead of the lad as a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would have come upon my father?" So, like Judah said that he would, he intercedes for Benjamin to try to make the most or make the best out of this situation. Now, so Joseph sees this, okay? Skip down to now chapter 45 and verse 1. "Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, 'Make everyone go out from me.' So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians of the house heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Does your father still live?' But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence." So imagine the shock. Okay, you're pulled back to Egypt, and you just know that's it. If you're lucky, you're gonna go to prison. But they go from feeling like everything is great to everything is a disaster, we're gonna die here, to this is Joseph. They can't even comprehend that this is Joseph. He's alive. This was a massive, massive shock to their minds. You know, this entire time they've been wringing their hands in despair, trying to figure out what they're going to do, how they're going to get by, right? And this was such a traumatizing event to them. We know the end of the story. They didn't know the end of the story. This was such a traumatizing event for them that long after everything is cleared up, let's jump over to chapter 50. Long after everything is cleared up, the events, all of these events, are still so much in their minds that after Jacob dies, okay, they're still thinking about everything that had happened to them. Chapter 50, and pick it up in verse 15. "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him.' So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, 'Before your father died, he commanded, saying, Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of God, your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him." Maybe it's only just now, maybe Joseph only just now realized all of the torment and agony that they went through. Continuing on, "Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' And Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in place of God?'" But he says, no, that's not going to happen. But the whole event was so traumatic for them, this was still weighing on their minds. Throughout this whole story, though, as we've gone through the agony, the decisions that they had to make, the things they had to do, have you ever thought, where was God? Now, you know, we read stories in the Bible, and we'll read, you know, then God did this or that, or he sent an angel to something. But when we read through this whole story, we can definitely see God's hand at work. But from the perspective of Jacob's sons, they must have felt completely abandoned. Do you think they spent time in prayer? Absolutely. Did Jacob himself pray and fast, desperately praying that Joseph would be found or that the famine would end? Absolutely. And to them at the time, as they were going through these events, it seemed all of that fell on deaf ears. If we go back now, back to chapter 45, chapter 45, and pick it up in verse 4. So now, this is right when Joseph showed himself to his brothers, saying, you know, I'm Joseph. And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. So they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now, do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me here before you to preserve life. For these 2 years, the family famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord of all of his house and a ruler throughout all of the land of Egypt. In reality, what had happened was God answered their prayers 20 years before they even knew what to pray for. They went through this whole ordeal, this incredible trial, and the entire time, God had already worked it all out. How they would not only live, but how they would flourish, how they would thrive. While in Egypt, they grew from a family of about 66 people to a nation of over 2 million. Matthew 6, verse 8, you don't have to turn there, but it says, for your father knows the things that you have need of before you ask him. What an amazing, I mean, we know that's true, but here, God worked this out 20 years in advance. So you see, we are creatures of worry, and we worry about everything. We must let that worry motivate us into action and even take drastic steps as necessary, like the sons of Jacob did. As Christians, we must maintain that healthy context, that healthy perspective, and remember that whatever it is that we're worried about, God has already worked out how we're going to get through it. He's just waiting for us to catch on.